Hey, Chutzpod listeners. I want to tell you quickly about another podcast that I think you might really like. It's called Love Letters. The show is hosted by Boston Globe advice columnist Meredith Goldstein, and it tells real people stories about dating, relationships, and falling in love. The theme of the new Love Letters season is thanks for the help. You'll hear beautiful stories about the many different ways that people get help or assistance in their romantic lives, from friends, relatives, from therapists, and even from their exes. Love Letters from the Boston Globe and PRX. New episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Josh.
Hello, Rabbi.
I am so excited to see your face and just your face for this recording.
You're tired of the exalted guests?
I have loved our guests. We've had some great feedback. People laughed so hard at Purim, the bat mitzvah episode. People laughed. They cried. I'm just ready to go back to the Torah portion with you and study some Torah.
It has been a while. My uncle, the honest skeptic, wrote to me and said, when are you going to get back to the Parshat HaShavua, the portion of the week? And the answer is today.
Do you see how we listen, how we respond to our listeners? We are just so responsive.
That's right. That's how you can tell we're a new podcast. Hopefully, we'll be, a year from now, we'll be jaded and not even reading what people write to us.
God forbid. That will never be us. As we're opening today, we want to actually talk about next week's podcast. And then we'll dive in to Shmini, which is this week's portion. We've been so grateful, as I said, for all of the hundreds of emails and tweets and posts that we've received from people. And there have been a lot of really good questions sent our way. Am I Jewish if X? Can I do this or that on a holiday? Why do Jews do Y? So we thought we'd do a mailbag episode. So send us your questions if you have more of them. We're going to pick a few of them.
You can email us at chutzpod@gmail.com.
Yes, please. Especially if you have some good Passover questions. We'll take them because we are, you know, in my house, the day after Purim is over is the day we stop basically food shopping. And we try to, except for like produce, we try to eat down everything in the house in this month before Passover starts.
Trying to get rid of all our chametz, the things that we cannot eat, are prohibited from eating on Passover. So try to clear it all out, eat everything. That's a good idea. That's what I should be doing.
Well, I will tell you that for the last 2 weeks before Passover, your kids are going to be really angry. The first 2 weeks are fine. You have enough fish sticks and things to get you through, pasta. But those final 2 weeks when you're like eating the bulgur wheat, that's when it gets a little dicey.
Yeah, the back of the pantry.
Actually, while we're already on the subject of food, Josh, let's get to this week's Torah portion, which is called Shmini. We're going to talk mostly about what happens toward the end of this portion, which is a lot about the laws of kashrut.
I'm excited to talk about the laws of kashrut, and I observe most of them. So, I mean, it's something I'm interested in exploring because I know kind of what it means to me. And it's the kind of thing that I often discuss with my friends who think, you know, I'm out of my mind or are just interested in why I follow such what seems like an arcane and random set of rules about what I eat.
Yeah. Every once in a while, the answer just has to be because. But I want to ask you a question. What is the craziest place that you've ever had to keep kosher, that you've ever had to figure out?
This is like the Jewish newlyweds.
Where specifically is the weirdest place that you personally have ever gotten the urge to make whoopee?
What's the craziest place you ever kept kosher? I do have an answer to that. Well, it's a Passover story, but I'll tell it now anyway. I'll tell it briefly. My son and daughter went to public school through fifth grade, and in fifth grade, the big thing you got for being in fifth grade was that you got a trip to D.C. I noticed that this trip, which every kid looked forward to, because when they're like seniors in fifth grade, they had scheduled it to take place over Passover, and not just over Passover, but the first 2 days, the nights of the Seders. And I went to the principal, and I said, you know, this thing coming up next year, you're going to want to move that, because you clearly, by mistake, scheduled over Passover. And then, lo and behold, returned from the summer. And they hadn't changed it. And there was like, it's a big meeting to get together and parents to discuss the trip. And so I went to this big meeting and I said, hey, just one quick thing. This has to be rescheduled. It was scheduled over Passover. You cannot do that. And everyone kind of looked at me like, what's wrong with this guy? And someone said, oh, you know, I didn't know it was Passover. I said, well, you know, you don't need a Jewish calendar to see when Passover is. You just need a calendar. And I'll bet you looked at a calendar when you scheduled this trip. I was like the obnoxious guy. And there were Jewish parents saying, it's no big deal. And I was like, no, it is a big deal. It's the single most widely observed holiday. And you literally cannot do this. Then in high dudgeon went to the principal and I was like, I bet somebody will want to cover, like some news will want to cover, like West Wing actor becomes activist. And I'm going to go and anybody who will listen, I'm going to say how it's just completely unacceptable. That anyway, they changed the whole schedule. Lots of people were mad at me. And my daughter, which I thought was adorable, had said, I won't even go on the trip if it's over. You know, if it's, I won't miss the Seders. And I was like, that's cute, but you don't have to make that decision. Yeah. It ended up being over Passover, but after the Seders, I did go on as a chaperone, and I couldn't eat at any of the places they had arranged. So I had these really weird self-heating kosher meals, a little box, and then you like shook a packet, which kind of bubbled and boiled, and people looked at me like I was from another planet as I sat in the back of the bus eating my weird little meat globules. So that's the weirdest place I've had to keep kosher.
There's so many things that story brings up. Like, for instance, this is like from the Torah, from the story of Joseph, the rabbis learn one of the goals of keeping kosher is actually to separate Jews from other people, which feels a little bit uncomfortable to us in a contemporary universalistic mindset. But that's like exactly what you're articulating. You kept yourself separate.
I certainly felt separate.
Yeah. And you might have felt proud, but my guess is you also felt hungry.
It was a combination of pride, hunger, and shame. I mean, I didn't really feel shame, but it was a little just embarrassed. I didn't have the time to, shall I explain to you why I'm the weird adult in the back of the school bus eating a bubbling hunk of unidentifiable food?
Here, on sale at Acme, a bubbling hunk of unidentified food.
Bet you can't eat just one.
It actually feels like there are conflicting Jewish values in your story, Josh. The laws of keeping kosher, for instance, are coming up against the laws around taking care of the environment, as I sort of like imagine you eating this disposable processed foods. One of the questions I want us to talk about today is, what does God want from us in terms of keeping kosher? Like, what is the goal here? And what happens when one goal or value hits up against another one? That's why keeping kosher is, on the one hand, people like to poo-poo it. What did you say earlier? Archaic and random.
The funny part is, that's what appeals to me about it. I like the, oh, I do this because I'm Jewish. And I agree with you. Like, there is something that also feels like, oh, you are trying to separate yourself and maybe you think you're better than I am. Although I certainly don't. I don't think like I'm better than you. I don't eat bacon. I'm just different. And it ties me into, and I am interested in greater meaning or exploring or thinking about a lot of aspects of it, but on the most surface level, like you do this because you're Jewish, really resonates for me because it just means I'm part of a multi-millennia tradition. It just helps anchor me in the world. The same way, you know, people who like a certain team like to wear the same face paint and the same outfit, the same shirt or something like that.
Over the years, I've started to get a little, I mean, it's not annoyed because it doesn't come from a malicious place, but I get a little chuffed when people say it feels so random. And I'm like, we've been doing it for 3,000 years, right? It's not random. It might feel random to you because it's not what you do. And that's why I do like the comparison in a way to like being part of a team. This is one of the things our team does. And I want to be part of this team. And that's why I decided to keep kosher.
So here are the rules as enumerated in this Torah portion, Shemini, about eating if you are keeping kosher. Fish must have fins and scales, right?
Yep.
Animals, beasts must have split hooves and chew their cud.
Do you know what it means to chew your cud?
That's how I eat at dinner. Yeah, I vomit and I eat it again and I kind of bring it back up and I work on it a little bit more. Isn't that chewing your cud?
That's exactly right.
So split hooves, chew your cud. We know that there are furthermore no bottom feeders with fish, no catfish doesn't work. Predatory animals, right? Like birds that are, well, I don't know, what kind of birds? Like you can't eat a hawk.
Well, the birds are interesting because all it says in the Torah is these are the ones you cannot eat, which is great because it means that all of the bird type creatures that the ancient rabbis had never heard of were allowed to
right.
eat. And so it actually has allowed us a wider range of birds that we can eat. But mostly it's chicken.
In one of the best meals I've ever had, my dad and I enjoyed a very delicious kosher pigeon pie, I believe called bestila, at a kosher Moroccan restaurant in Jerusalem called Darna, one of the great meals of my life.
Oof, that sounds like something I've never eaten before.
It's really, really good. And then even certain insects are kosher, right?
Yeah, which is very important.
Which is good because I think sometime in the future, we're all going to be eating grasshopper and grasshopper flour, or crickets are okay, or locusts.
First of all locusts are grasshoppers, I think. I had to learn this one.
There's something in this portion about jumpy insects seem to be okay.
Yes, they have to have certain sorts of joints. And I think you're right, Josh, actually. Have you ever had grasshoppers?
I have not. I'm not in a hurry, although I understand that I think in terms of sustaining the world population, this may be where we are headed.
Yeah, that's why it's good that we can eat beetles, not so much. Grasshoppers, yes.
Yes, self-serve frozen grasshopper gelato is in our future, I think. Invest now.
Unless we figure out how to eradicate climate change.
Right. Well, that'd be another way to go about it. So yeah, what else? Any other laws that I'm not thinking of? Also, let me ask you this. I mean, I read the portion. The laws about kosher slaughtering are not in this?
Yes.
A cow is a kosher animal. You can eat a cow. There are a lot of rules that are not in this portion, but I guess are later in the Torah that discuss how an animal can be slaughtered properly, which is why I don't eat a hamburger in a non-kosher restaurant, even though I can eat a hamburger at home that I've bought from a kosher butcher.
Are there laws in the Torah that say how to kill an animal? I think it's one of these times where in Deuteronomy, God says you should kill these sheep and cattle the way that I have instructed you. But it actually doesn't say anywhere in Torah what the instructions are.
That's fascinating. It's kind of like a saucy little treasure hunt run by God.
It's Judaism in a nutshell. Judaism, a saucy little treasure hunt. A lot of the rules around keeping kosher, it comes from what we call rabbinic Judaism, which really came to the forefront in, like, let's say the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century CE, more than 1,000 years after parts of the Torah were written. And we Jews are what's called rabbinic Jews. So anyway, all of that is a long way of saying, I would say a solid majority of laws around keeping kosher were actually created after the Torah, but most of them you can draw a straight line back to the Torah. Maybe not straight, but slightly squiggly line back to the Torah, and we can see what their origin was and what they became.
So would it be fair to say that part of the rabbinic take that they were trying to add to kosher was a humanitarian aspect? I know one of the things they came up with is like a cow has to be killed in a single stroke painlessly. And were they not trying? I'm trying to pep up the squad here. Were they not trying to give us a humane approach to killing the animals that we eat and consume? Or am I making that up?
I'm going to be honest with you, Josh.
Please do.
It's not clear. And so I do think one can make an argument that to a certain extent they were trying to make it less painful for the animal. When you say that you cannot have a meal with dairy and a meal with meat at the same time, it's a way of reminding us that you are actually eating a being that was alive. And how to a certain extent, if we want to eat animals or the product of animals, we actually have a responsibility to acknowledge a loss of life. So there are certainly some who argue that this is an attempt to be more humane and more thoughtful about the animals that we're eating. And certainly people who hold by that teaching also will often say that the ideal way of eating, and this is part of our tradition.
That is my understanding of it. We have a mutual friend, William Daroff, who's a vegan. And I think he sees that as the apotheosis of kosher. I have a daughter who's a vegetarian. I eat less and less meat as I get older, even though I'm an avowed carnivore. I love meat, but it's not good for the environment. It's certainly not good for the animals. I feel like I'm slowly working my way a rung at a time towards maybe doing what I feel inside is the right thing and become a vegetarian. Oof.
I like to call myself an aspiring vegan or a vegan who cheats. I don't know. Aspiring feels more positive. There is this midrash, this teaching that until the flood with Noah and the ark, until that moment, all of humanity were vegetarians. And when the flood happened, God thought to God's self, wow, these humans that I've created are violent and they need a way to take out their violence.
Oh, wow.
And so what if we allowed them to channel, this is like the way that like my husband is so happy I just got a punching bag in the basement. Like what if we allow a way to channel their impulse to aggression by allowing them to kill animals and eat them, but they still have to do it in a very specific way.
And that is why God told Noah to take 2 of every kind of meat and put it on a boat.
That's right. Or 7, depending on which part of the story you're reading.
Oh, but I would say in retrospect, I don't think meat eating got all our aggression out, given the subsequent history of man. It wasn't an entirely successful experiment.
Well, I don't know. Could you imagine how much worse it would have been?
Well, there you go. That's a very Jewish response. Good answer. You think the world's bad now?
See what happens when we had to have a bunch of William Daroffs running around. All these vegans.
If we were all vegetarians.
You know, we were talking about what is the reason for keeping kosher. Is it more healthy? And certainly when I was growing up, you would still hear people saying, oh yeah, we don't eat pigs because pigs are dirty animals. And it's like, give me a break.
Right. Or they had trichinosis. Well, but that does make me want to ask you, one thing that did strike me is the language around the rules of kashrut included, you know, don't eat this for it is an abomination. I was like, oh, I never thought of these animals as an abomination. In fact, I always thought in a way it's almost like exalting. No, we don't kill and eat those animals. Not that I really felt they were exalted, but I never thought of them as bad or negative or interesting to me that it was an abomination. Why?
We're not going to use the word abomination. We're going to use the Hebrew word, which is to'eva. And there's a reason for it, because the English word that it's translated to, abomination, has obviously a very negative connotation. So the Hebrew word to'eva means something different than the English word abomination. A to'eva is a socially constructed boundary. Let me explain what I mean there. It's something that is not universally forbidden, right? Like murder. Most people think murder is not okay. It doesn't matter if they have a religion, they don't have a religion. Lying. We talked about lying. So maybe I need a better example. But like most people think speaking falsehoods is not okay, right? Any moral code worth its salt would forbid these things. But a to'eva is something that is forbidden within one culture or religion, but not necessarily within others, like keeping kosher, right? We don't believe that non-Jews are going to hell because they don't keep kosher. They're not Jewish, so they don't have to do it. And so therefore, the English word abomination doesn't really work, because that's for more universally forbidden things, like incest, for instance. And, you know, for those who want to know more about this, I recommend there's a piece by Rabbi Seth Goldstein. We can link to it on our website that really teaches about this. And there's a reason why I am going down what might seem to you people to be a rabbit hole about this word to'eva.
Unkosher. Rabbits, unkosher. Go down a cow hole.
There's a reason I'm going down this cow hole about the word to'eva, because there is another time in our Torah when the word is used, and that's when it's talking about homosexuality. And there are a thousand ways that the teachings about homosexuality have been overturned, but just in this one moment, I want people to start to separate out the word abomination from homosexuality. So that's why I'm so glad you asked that, because it opens the door for another conversation I want to have in the future.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad too. Because I occasionally have very solicitous friends who are like saying, do you mind if I order shrimp? And I'm like, well, I don't care. You know, they say it as if, do you object to this animal? Like, no, I just don't eat it. I have no problem with it. It's not an abomination to me.
I do get that from congregants. You know, if I'm out to a meal with a congregant, they're like, Rabbi, are you okay with me having this bacon double cheeseburger? And I'm like, I do sometimes feel out of kavod harav, out of respect for the rabbi, maybe given that, like, there's so much good vegetarian food on the menu, you know, these days, like, maybe have your Impossible Burger with me and then have your bacon double cheeseburger tonight.
By the way, very thankful to be someone who keeps kosher in the modern day. It's so easy now to eat, at least as a vegetarian, just about anywhere you go. It's very freeing and it makes it a lot easier to keep kosher.
And I can even go to a Burger King now. Do you want to hear my hardest, my most difficult kashrut moment thus far in my whole life?
Yes, please.
Russell and I traveled around the world for a year before I started rabbinical school, and one of the places we went was Ecuador. And in Ecuador, we traveled through rural Ecuador for 2 weeks with a priest. His name was Padre Wilson, Father Wilson. So the way more or less that Padre Wilson earned an income was it was all a barter system. And the people who he served, he spoke fluent Spanish, but he served mostly indigenous people who spoke no Spanish. So we're traveling through rural Ecuador, and we get to this tiny, tiny village. And Padre Wilson goes out to talk to the people, and he does a baptism or two. And then they find out that there are these Americans who are there. And so they want to throw us a fancy meal between having Padre Wilson there and having these two Americans there.
Oh, no.
So we sit down at the table. It feels like the entire village is there. Maybe there were like 50 people all staring at us, right? We were the only ones given food. It was not a very wealthy village. And they give us these huge bowls filled with potatoes and guinea pig.
Oh, dear.
Which is a delicacy. The way that we here in America eat cows or lamb or whatever.
Sure. Culture clash.
And just P.S., the guinea pigs actually look like guinea pigs.
Oh, I had them as a kid.
So I really don't know what to do in that moment, right? Russell, sure. I don't know what to do because guinea pigs are not kosher. And so we try to explain to Padre Wilson, we can't eat this. And Padre Wilson says, what? No, you have to eat it.
This is going to be a huge insult if you don't.
Right. These people have like slaughtered some of their, and we went back and forth and he's like translating into language these indigenous Ecuadorians spoke and we didn't eat it.
I'm guessing they didn't have a word for kosher.
They had a word for Jews. I kept hearing him say, judeos. That was a Spanish word. I don't know if there was a word in their language for it. And Padre Wilson, God bless him, ate all three of the guinea pigs because that's what he decided would be the kindest thing to do.
He took one for the team.
He was sick for 36 hours from overeating.
And did you and Russell ate guinea pig flavored potato?
So we did eat the guinea pig flavored potatoes. It was still hard for us, right? Because it's just not a taste that we're used to. And to this day, like we were talking earlier about the values, right? When different values come up against each other, it's like, what was the value? We were placing ourselves squarely within the value of Jewish peoplehood and Jewish separatism. We were placing ourselves squarely outside the value of respecting the other, the dignity of the other. And then we're like, or was it because it was guinea pig? Like, let's say they had given us, pork would have been hard, but I don't know. Let's say they had given us a cheeseburger.
Ecuadorian cheeseburger. I knew you were going there. You obviously have a thing. I think that is your transgressive side. You dream
it
of
is.
Cheeseburgers. I know.
I do. It's totally true.
It's a thing. It's a real thing with you.
With like the melted cheese and the burger with the juices dripping down. Anyway, what were we talking about? I was also wondering if it was like, because like to eat this, we would have had to tear the arm off a guinea pig, right? And it just felt to me like I too had had guinea pigs. I had had, in college, I had two guinea pigs named Tipper and Hillary. To this day, I feel a little bit embarrassed that we made the wrong choice.
Oh, well. They were not offended, though, right?
The truth is, Josh, I actually have no idea whether they were offended or not. I would understand if they were.
I think about what I would do on Survivor, because I'm a big fan of Survivor, and a little part of me wishes I could compete. There is a vegetarian, maybe even a vegan, on this season, and he's like starving, and they caught a crab, a hermit crab, and he finally was like, I'm going to eat a little hermit crab. And I was always thinking, I wouldn't. You can't do it for a game show. There's a concept, I think, from the rabbis of pikuach nefesh, which is to say, if your life is in danger, you don't say, I can't eat a cheeseburger. That would be an abomination to God. Not that we use that word anymore. We are not meant to risk our lives in pursuit of these laws of kashrut. But if you opted into a game like Survivor, I don't think it's fair to say that I'm trying to save my life here. I just want to talk about Survivor, Rabbi.
It is not 100% clear that for the sake of pikuach nefesh, of saving a life, there are certain circumstances where you actually have to die rather than eat. I know.
Wait, so I've stumbled into something where I'm interested.
Everything else up until now has been boring.
Can you give me an example where God would have me die rather than eat unkosher?
Yeah. So like one, especially the example, for instance, of, and this has happened in Jewish history. It's one of the things that actually caused the Maccabees to revolt against the Syrian Greeks in the story of Hanukkah, which is that sometimes anti-Semites or people who were oppressing Jews would force Jews to eat pork in front of large groups of people as a way of getting the Jews to turn their backs on their religion. And in those instances, there are ancient rabbinic teachings that say that you really are supposed to allow yourself to be killed rather than do it. We could look into the halacha of it. I'm not an authority.
Well, those are not my favorite ancient rabbis.
There was a time there was more of a concept of martyrdom than we have today. I think about that, you know, because when I was growing up in Jewish day school, I was very much like, I would never eat pork. I'd rather die. But now I think about it as a mother, and I'm like, I would stuff my kids' faces full of pork without even thinking about it.
Yes. I took it as a point of pride that it was like, there's all these rules and all these rules and all these rules, but don't go crazy with it. Like, hey, wait a minute. You don't have to die for this. It's just pork. But apparently, it's not that easy. Nothing is that simple with Judaism.
One of the roles that Torah plays right now is in giving people a mirror to what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, and maybe even a window to where they want to go.
I'm Alana Steinheim, Rosh Beit Midrash and Senior Fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute. I'm excited to share that I am the host of Texting, a new podcast where ancient wisdom meets contemporary relevance from Hartman's award-winning digital team. On each show, Hartman scholars Christine Hayes, Yona Hain, or Leah Robotnitsky will join me to delve into a Torah text that offers insight and inspiration about the issues that matter to you and to our community.
I got the feeling from the various explanations that the rabbis gave that God also feels broken.
You can listen to Texting at shalomhartman.org/texting or wherever you get your podcasts. I look forward to learning with you.
Let's talk about halal a little bit, because there are Muslim dietary laws that are very similar to ours. Yes?
Yes. I really don't want to speak about things I don't know that much about.
If I went by that, I couldn't say anything, but go ahead.
As I understand it, halal and kashrut are a little bit like squares and rectangles in that most, I want to make sure I get this right, most kosher food is also halal, right? Unless it has like alcohol in it or something, I guess, right? Most kosher food is also halal, but most halal food is not also kosher.
Mm-hmm. So there's certain rules we follow in common. No blood, certain animals.
That's right. And this is especially when we're talking about meat, the eating of meat. Because when it comes to things like, I don't know, Cheerios, they can easily both be halal and kosher at the same time. I have been tempted, because there are more and more halal restaurants here in D.C. And there have been times when I've been tempted to like just go in and eat halal.
Just for the halal of it. Sorry. And that's the end of our show, folks.
I don't know. I feel like if one of the goals is separatism, right, there still is sort of like a way that you are sort of separating yourself. You're still being mindful of what you're eating. I do think we can do more work to sort of build relationships between Muslims and Jews and to be respectful of Islam, but I haven't done it yet.
Do it. Do it. And come back and report for the show. Take pictures, take a little video, and report back from the field.
We're hoping in a few weeks to have Dan Pashman from The Sporkful on our podcast. And he just had a great episode a few weeks ago where he brought a practicing Jew and a practicing Muslim onto the podcast. They cooked impossible pork together and then they ate it together. These two people who had never eaten pork in their life.
That's fantastic.
And responded to this feeling of eating something that's so taboo, even though it's not, because it's not actual pork at all. It's not treif, by which we mean unkosher.
I like the word treif. And correct me if I'm wrong, as I digress, treif means torn. And that's a reference to one of the other things that would make an animal unkosher, I think, is if you can't tear a limb off a living animal and eat it. I always thought this was also a humanitarian thing. Now you'll tell me some horrible story that explains why it's not at all about compassion.
Look, it's not that it's not at all about compassion. It's just that today we understand compassion toward animals in a way that the rabbis just didn't a few thousand years ago. So it's not that they forbade compassion for animals. It's just that, like, I think it would be disingenuous to pretend that that was the reason that they created all these laws around keeping kosher.
Just give me it's a reason for some of this. Single stroke, painless, right? Don't tear an animal. Don't eat a piece of a living animal. That's got to be at least, hey, that's not nice. There's an element of that, right? Don't do that. That's not nice.
Here's what I would say. You know, I'm looking at my notes, Josh, and I have a list of all the reasons that people keep kosher. And I do think compassion for animals is in the top three. In the top three are compassion for animals, to keep Jews sort of unified as a people, and because God told us to. Now, some of the other reasons that people, or other ways that people keep kosher in contemporary times, come from very deep and important Jewish values, like, for instance, the value of worker justice. We have law upon law in the Talmud and afterwards, and in the Torah, about how we're supposed to treat the people who work for us. And yes, that's certainly something that's been forgotten all over the place in the United States of America and other countries as well. So we have those laws in Judaism. It's just that the ancient rabbis didn't necessarily connect keeping kosher to laws of worker justice. And so we have a lot of laws about how to treat our animals well. It's just that the rabbis didn't always connect them to keeping kosher specifically.
I would also add that for me also, the laws of kashrut, and this could be accomplished with any other set of laws about eating, but just the fact that there are laws around eating, it makes the activity of eating sanctified to me. It's something I do many times a day. I'm a big eater. And it just, every time I do it, it reminds me of a lot of things. I have to be a little bit more mindful about my eating because of these rules that I followed. That makes me more mindful about the fact just that I have food. It makes me thankful. There are also, this is probably, I started doing this after watching Shtisel, but I now say the prayer in my head. We have a different prayer for every food that we eat. And I say them in my head and I never used to. And so that's another thing where like, I'm being grateful. I'm literally saying a prayer like, wow, thank you for making this apple. I have an apple that I can, and it really does change the way I move through the day.
I could not agree with you more. Before I was talking about like the top three rules, top three reasons to keep kosher. I would add as like part of the top three, a fourth reason, which is mindfulness. When I used to teach about keeping kosher, I would talk about it as a mindfulness eating practice based on Jewish teachings, right? Mindfulness, first of all, is something that people understand. And not putting anything in your mouth, right, is also something that people understand nowadays, whether for health reasons or because they like to eat delicious food or local food or whatever it is. And that's what Jews have been doing for thousands of years. We have had a mindful eating practice, which includes thinking about every single thing we eat, what we're going to eat, what we used to eat. It sounds like the beginning of a Jewish joke. You know, it's like, what are we having for lunch tomorrow? It's one of the things my mother-in-law gets most annoyed about me. It's like, what are we having for dinner on Thursday night? I'm always asking. She's like, can we just have breakfast on Monday?
My mother had that every day. My mother was a terrific cook. And I'd always say, what's for dinner? And she'd say, you'll find out when you come down. But I was like, I don't mean this to treat you like a cook. I'm excited for whatever you have.
You know, after the temple was destroyed in 70-ish CE and the Jews were sent out of the land of Israel into the diaspora and we had to basically recreate Judaism, one of the things that the rabbis taught was that our home becomes Mikdash Me'at. It becomes the little temple. And the table that we sit around is the altar at which we make offerings to God. We make offerings to God in two ways, with what we eat and with what we say. In the Jewish tradition, it is against Jewish law to eat standing up. Obviously, the ancient rabbis had no law against eating in the car because they didn't have cars back then. But this idea that eating is a sacred moment. You're supposed to be sitting down, and any meal that does not have a word of Torah, a sacred moment, is considered a wasted meal.
At my family, we try to all be looking at the same screen as we eat. No, I like this idea. I will say some of the most sacred time at my house is when my whole family is around the table and we don't have screens and we're talking to each other and eating. Definitely eating is part sustaining ourselves with each other. The conversation also helping sustain us. Like, I totally get that.
Yeah, I do agree with you. So there is something about keeping kosher that helps remind us to keep meals sacred. And like the rabbis could never have imagined a time where like you could heat up your burrito in the microwave before getting in the car and eating it and like having it drip down your shirt. And, you know, here we are. And so perhaps we need mindfulness-based Jewish eating practices even more now than we did a few thousand years ago. And the other thing is, I think there is something to be said for discipline. And people who work out understand that, right? People who have ever tried to gain weight or lose weight understand that. You have to have a specific way that you do something and you have to stick with it. And that's what kashrut is. It might not always be meaningful, but in order for it to be meaningful sometimes, you have to do it all the time. I want to be very careful about how we're talking about this right now, which I know you do too, because we don't want people to feel ashamed for how much or how little they eat or what they're eating.
Of course, it's a very fraught subject altogether for a lot of reasons.
Fraught is a great word because people who have different types of disordered eating, kashrut can be very difficult for them to have a way that they restrict themselves. It can become very complicated. I've had more than one student who has decided they really don't want to, like kashrut is not going to be their Jewish practice at all because of the way that food functions in their life. I think about how in this week's Torah portion, to return to it, the Torah portion concludes with God giving a reason for the rules of kashrut, and it has to do with holiness. We should be holy because God is holy. You hear that throughout the entire book of Leviticus. And you know, there are times when we are eating too much or too little or the wrong thing, however we define the wrong thing, you know, like eating 7 pieces of pizza, even though we're lactose intolerant, which I maybe have done once or twice, where it's like, there is a way we're not honoring what's holy about our bodies. And that is something that God, in this week's Torah portion, reminds us is at the core. So whether we choose kashrut or whether we choose eating only free-range grass-fed products, organic products. Holiness needs to always be at the core.
Well said. As we wrap up another episode of our podcast, is that the big takeaway that we get from Parashat Shemini, from this portion of the Torah, sanctifying our activities and making holy the act of eating, quintessential, the basic thing you need for survival food?
Yeah, I think for me, the takeaway from having this conversation about kashrut and eating is that members of the Jewish community, as people who are walking this path, before we put food in our mouth, there are certain questions that we should ask. We should ask, was this food created compassionately, like in a compassionate way? So that could be the people who helped to grow it or pick the fruits or prepare the food. The animals, if we're eating animals, was there a compassionate way that they were brought to our table? And also, is it compassionate for me? You know, if I'm having my 75th Hershey's Kiss of the day, what is that about? Is it, am I treating my body compassionately? And which leads us to holiness, I think, right? Is it holy? Is it feeding or is it eating? Are we sitting at the altar when we're doing it? And the third is somehow, is it connecting? Is it connecting us to God, to other people, to our culture, to our history, to community, right? Compassionate, holy, and connecting. Those are sort of the three ideas that I'm taking with me. Now, for me, because I don't feel like having the conversation with myself all the time, I feel like just eating vegetarian is just easier because not always. But often, because I'm not engaging in the animal part of it, there's more of a chance that there's compassion there. But that's where kashrut is trying to drive us. What do you think?
No, I struggle with it because I feel like I've come to that conclusion mentally, but I'm not quite there yet. There's something bleak to me about, oh, am I really never going to have meat again? It's the weak part of me where I feel like I'm not struggling with, do I think that vegetarianism or veganism is the apotheosis of being kosher? I think it is. I'm already there. It's the animal part of me that's having trouble keeping up with the higher, more spiritual part of me.
Right, which is why it's important to not throw out the baby with the bathwater. No, oh no, let me say a better one, less violent one. It's so important not to let the...
Don't throw out the chicken carcass with the soup, something like that.
Right. I was going to say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good enough.
That's better. That's a better rabbi take, yeah.
Just because you can't be vegan all the time doesn't mean that you shouldn't try sometimes. We can always be growing and changing and evolving and becoming more holy, more compassionate, more connecting in the way that we eat. That's another episode. It's another episode of Chutzpod.
Yes, we've done it. Let's thank, first and foremost, Tim Shovers, our executive producer. Thank you, Tim. PRX, the wonderful organization that distributes us and helped us develop the show. You can learn more about them at prx.org. Thanks also to our sponsors. Please check them out. When you support them, you support the podcast. We would also like to shout out and thank Chutzpod intern, Aiden Roberts. We want to thank Hadag Nachash. They let us use their fabulous song, Lazuz, for every opening. And I did notice one funny thing, which is that in the middle of the Purim meditation that I did, guided meditation, I asked people to give us a 5-star review. I said, because the show's pretty good and it's free. And I noticed a 5-star review today that says, it's pretty good and it's free. I thought that was really funny. So if you all want to do that, it'll be even funnier. You can write to us. You can tweet at us. You can check out our Instagram, all that good stuff. I'm very excited now to introduce one of my best friends in the world, Noah Emmerich, who's going to help us review the Hebrew, Yiddish, Spanish, and Arabic words that we've used during this episode. Noah is one of my oldest friends. We were housemates in college. We've been buddies for 30 years. You recognize him from Little Children and The Truman Show. More recently, he's starring in Suspicion on Apple TV Plus. He won a Critics' Choice Award for Best Supporting Actor for his amazing portrayal of Stan Beeman in The Americans. I love him. You will love him. Here's Noah.
Toiva. Toiva is a Hebrew word used in the Torah to refer to sinful behavior. Chametz, Hebrew word for all foods with leavening agents that are forbidden to be eaten on Passover. It'd be nice to get gefilte fish added to this list. Mikdash Ma'at. Mikdash Ma'at, Hebrew, literally small temple, can refer to synagogues, study houses, and homes. Hobbits go to Mikdash Ma'at. Jewish hobbits, of course. Kavod Harav, Hebrew, respect for the rabbi. Aretha spells it R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Rabbi Shira spells it Kaf Vet Vav Dalet. Chubios is the Spanish word for shoes. Halal, Arabic, literally lawful or permitted, the opposite of the Arabic word haram, which means forbidden. Treif, Yiddish derived from the Hebrew word treifa. It refers literally to flesh torn by beasts, but has come to stand for anything non-kosher. Pikuach nefesh. This is the Jewish principle that the sanctity of life generally trumps the observance of ritual. Pikachu nefesh is an Israeli Pokemon character.
Nice work, Pop Dude. That's what we call each other. Now, do stick around, because before we say goodbye, the rabbi will lead you in a brief guided meditation.
Although I'm a little bit self-conscious because Josh did such an excellent job last week at the Purim episode. And I do want to remind everyone to send us your questions, chutzpah@gmail.com. We want them. We're only going to be able to pick a few, but maybe it'll be yours. Please send them in and we will try to answer as many as possible on the podcast next week. So settle in. Maybe some of you are eating right now. And if you are, that's fine. Maybe you're walking around your kitchen cooking for your family. Whatever it is you're doing, just take a second to breathe and to notice that you're breathing. I want to tell you a story. I want to tell you a story about the first time in the Torah that someone ate without thinking about it. We go back to the Garden of Eden and to Adam and to Eve and to the serpent. And we are reminded of the conversation that Eve and the serpent had before she ate of the forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge. She thought about what she was doing before she didn't, but Adam did not. She gave me the fruit, he says to God, when God tells Adam that he should not have eaten it. She just gave me the fruit and I eat it, he says, in a little grammatical error. Adam is the first example then of mindless eating, of eating without recognizing that there is holiness, as our Hasidic masters teach, in every single bite. There is a spark of the divine in every piece of food that we eat, in every meal that we share, when we sit around our table in our Mikdash Me'at, our small temple, when we sit around the altar and speak words of Torah. So may this be a week of good eating, by which we mean of mindful eating, of thinking about your food, of actually tasting it, not just inhaling it, of trying to eat food that is more compassionate for you, for yourself, or for others, that is more holy, and that is more connecting. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
This is Big Red Noah Emmerich wishing you all a Shabbat Shalom.